because the conditions were so poor. Videos have been circulating on WhatsApp of the conditions inside. There's only four showers for over 500 people. There's not enough running water. The beds are head to tail. And more importantly, there's a lot of issues right now with communicable diseases, COVID-19, chickenpox. We've been dealing with these outbreaks at the 25 shelters we serve across New York City. And I understand the interest to want to house migrant families, but you can't create a second class of citizens just because they're asylum seekers, just because they're single men, and put them in a different kind of shelter, a detention camp, just because they're single men.
So will they stay outside the Watson at this point where they are camped out over the last few days after being evicted from the hotel?
Yeah, I'm here with one of the migrants as well in the car, and he has told me that the call right now for migrants is to be allowed back into their rooms at the Watson, to be put into permanent housing, not just shelter to shelter. We keep shuffling people around like they're not real human beings with lives and needs and health. They need everyone. All New Yorkers have a right to permanent, stable housing. And like the attorney said on the call earlier, they're not moving people fast enough from the shelters.
Desiree Joy Frias, we want to thank you for being with us, community organizer with South Bronx Mutual Aid, helping folks outside the Watson Hotel, and Josh Goldfein, staff attorney for the Legal Aid Society. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Maria Teresena and Sanji Lopez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Saddle up and ride with country music in your head from 6 till 9 every Saturday morning on KBOO Swingin' Country. You can count on Swingin' Country's stable of rotating hosts to fill your early morning with country, alternative country, western, western swing, and even some rockabilly, bluegrass, and Americana tunes. Swingin' Country on KBOO is mighty fine, Saturday morning, 6 to 9.
If your eyes are on me, you're looking at country.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland parks and sewer workers prepare to strike tomorrow.
The Grants Pass kidnapping suspect dies in a police standoff.
And the College Board revises its AP African American Studies program after conservative backlash.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 1st, 2023. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Over 600 Portland City employees in the Portland City Laborers Union plan to strike on Thursday if no agreement is reached with the city in their contract bargaining. Local 483 represents city workers in wastewater treatment, sewer repair, parks maintenance, and snow and ice transportation. Their contract with the city expired last summer, and bargaining has been ongoing since last March. They say a needed cost of living increase amidst rising inflation is where the sides are at an impasse. Union workers want a 3.5% annual raise for all workers for the first 2 years of the contract, and cost of living adjustments that are indexed to inflation. The current inflation rate is just over 7%. The city offers a 1% raise and a 5% cost of living adjustment for the first 2 years. The city reportedly says their offer is what the city can afford right now, and that it's generous. James O'Loughlin is a representative of Local 483. He told OPB, quote, "The city continues to plead poverty, but every 6 months, they seem to find tens of thousands in the budget that were not there," end quote. Every 6 months, the city has a budget redo process where they reshuffle city funds. Local 483 says they haven't seen proof that the city can't afford what they're asking for. The potential strike has Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler declaring a state of emergency, which allows him to hire contract workers to cover the striking workers' duties.
Law enforcement officials in Grants Pass have been warning women over the past week to be careful on dating apps. On January 24th, a woman was found unconscious, bound, and near death in a house in Grants Pass. Since then, a manhunt has been on for the person responsible. The suspect was Benjamin Obadiah Foster, who died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound in a standoff with police. The manhunt over the past week in Southwest Oregon was intensified when the bodies of two men were found in a rural area north of Grants Pass. Authorities suspect Foster was also involved in their deaths and may have stolen their dog, which he was seen walking in town yesterday. Foster moved to Oregon in 2019 and before that lived in Las Vegas. There, he held his then-girlfriend captive inside her apartment for 2 weeks. He pled guilty in August of 2021 to felony battery and misdemeanor domestic violence. He was sentenced to a 1 to 2.5 year jail sentence in Nevada. But since he served 729 days awaiting trial, he was released the day he was brought to prison, 200 days short of his maximum sentence.
The author of a new book on the death penalty suggests that people's support for capital punishment could be linked to their own fear of death. Eric Tagadoff spoke with the author, Philip Hanston, to learn more.
A new book by a University of Washington professor on the death penalty finds support for executions may be motivated by people's own fear of death. Philip Hanston is a professor emeritus at the University of Washington and author of Death Penalty BS, in which he argues against the practice. Hanston draws on work by Ernest Becker, an anthropologist who said that reminding people of their own mortality made them cling tighter to their cultural views and even increases people's punitive urges in order to defend their culture. Hanston says hearing about a murder could cause somebody to think more about death, especially if it happens in their community.
The murderers are an outgroup in general. I mean, most of us aren't murderers, so the murderer is automatically an outgroup, somebody who we would tend to protect our culture from anyway.
Hanston says this could make people more likely to support the death penalty. He also notes that the fear of death can inspire xenophobia and racism in people who feel they need to protect their culture. Becker's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Denial of Death, led to the creation of a study known as terror management theory. Hanston says Becker's theory puts death row in a new light.
If the terror of death has such a huge influence on all of us, putting people on death row for decades, it would be hard for me to imagine something more cruel than that.
Hanston says terror management theory also makes it clear that people don't necessarily create their views on issues like the death penalty with their rational minds.
You give them all this data and all the rational arguments and show how it's totally arbitrary, et cetera, and it just falls on deaf ears because this death terror is preventing them from hearing it.
70% of the royalties for Hanston's book go to the group Death Penalty Focus. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tagadoff.
The College Board, the company that produces AP curriculum, has faced heavy criticism from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and other conservatives. Today, they released a revision to their official curriculum for the new advanced placement course in African American Studies, excluding much of the subject matter that had angered conservatives. The testing company purged the names of many Black writers and scholars associated with critical race theory, the queer experience, and Black feminism. They also removed topics like Black Lives Matter from the curriculum. The College Board even added Black conservatism as an idea for a research project. Besides DeSantis and Florida, the College Board faced the possibility of opposition in over 24 states that have adopted some sort of measure against the teaching of critical race theory. David Coleman, the head of the College Board, said that the changes were all made for pedagogical reasons, not in reaction to political pressure.
The Boeing company delivered its final 747 jumbo jet yesterday, ending a more than 50-year run for the popular model. The final plane was the 1,574th built by Boeing in the Puget Sound area. It debuted in 1969. Since then, the 747 has served as a cargo plane, a commercial aircraft, transportation for NASA's space shuttles, and the Air Force One presidential aircraft. It connected international cities that never before had direct routes. But for the last 15 years, Boeing and European rival Airbus have made more profitable and more fuel-efficient wide-body planes, with only two engines instead of the 747's four. Boeing decided to build the 747 after losing a contract for a giant military transport plane, the C-5A. The company planned to take advantage of the new engines developed for the transport on a civilian aircraft, They were described as high bypass turbofan engines, which burn less fuel and can fly much further. It took more than 50,000 Boeing workers less than 16 months to produce the first 747. That required the construction of a massive factory in Everett, north of Seattle, the world's largest building by volume. The 747 was said to democratize airline travel. It couldn't be filled with people paying full price, so airlines lowered prices to get people on board. Delta was the last U.S. airline to use a 747 for passenger flights, which ended in 2017. Some international carriers continue to fly it, including the German airline Lufthansa.
The Senate considers police reforms in the wake of Tyre Nichols' killing. Members of Congress want a new vote on the Equal Rights Amendment, and George Santos voluntarily steps down from his committee appointments. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Politics too often gets in the way of doing what every American knows is common sense. Here we find ourselves again, Mr. President, having the same conversation with no action having happened so far.
South Carolina Senator Tim Scott does not want to see politics and partisanship get in the way of making changes to policing. After the death of Tyre Nichols, Scott wants to see Democrats and Republicans come together to make changes with police de-escalation tactics. And he's not alone. Texas Senator John Cornyn is hoping to improve the way police interact with people in custody. In 2022, Cornyn's Law Enforcement De-escalation Training Act was passed, requiring the Justice Department to develop de-escalation tactics, alternatives to use of force, and methods to safely respond to someone experiencing a mental health crisis. He says preventable tragedies like Nichols' death need to be avoided.
Use of force should only come into play when absolutely necessary. And this legislation will provide law enforcement officers with the knowledge of what alternatives are available to them.
Members of Congress are calling for a new vote on the Equal Rights Amendment. The idea was first presented nearly a century ago and passed by Congress in 1972. It failed to gain ratification by the required 34 states by the deadline in 1982. A total of 38 states have ratified it at one time, and 5 have since rescinded their votes, so it would require a new round of voting to be added to the Constitution. Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono feels had it passed then, it could have affected recent historic decisions.
I agree with the scholars who say that if the ERA had been in effect, perhaps the Supreme Court would have had to pause before doing away with protections under Roe because they would be discriminating against pretty much a gender-specific medical procedure.
House Republicans have approved a bill to end the COVID-19 federal public health emergency overnight, instead of in May, as President Joe Biden has announced. It's almost certain to fail in the Senate. The bill was introduced by Kentucky Representative Brett Guthrie, who feels the emergency needs to end now.
President Biden has taken too long to act on this statement last September that the pandemic is over, which is why I am moving forward with my bill to end the COVID-19 public health emergency and finally restore checks and balances between Congress and the executive branch.
New York Representative George Santos has voluntarily stepped down from his 2 committee appointments, but says he will be cleared by an investigation into his campaign financing and claims he made about his personal life while running for office. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
It's American Heart Month, and an Arizona cardiac specialist is shedding light on the important differences and similarities between a heart attack and cardiac arrest. He says these medical emergencies affect different functions of the heart. Alex Gonzalez has the details.
February is American Heart Month, and an Arizona expert says it's important to know the signs of a heart attack versus cardiac arrest. Dr. Wilbur Sue with Banner Health in Phoenix says both are medical emergencies that require immediate life-saving attention, but they are different conditions. He explains a heart attack happens when a blocked artery affects blood flow, and blood carries oxygen to the heart. Cardiac arrest involves the sudden malfunctioning of the heart's electrical impulse, which means it stops pumping. Sue says if you think you're having either one, call 911 as soon as possible.
offer help and start chest compression, because then somebody has to keep the blood circulating to provide blood flow to the brain, a vital organ, so that we can keep the person alive.
Sue says arteries are often blocked by a buildup of fat or cholesterol. Some of the most common heart attack signs include tightness, pressure, or an aching sensation in the chest that can spread through the upper body, plus shortness of breath, fatigue, and dizziness. Cardiac arrest is a leading cause of death in the U.S., with over 356,000 cases a year, 90% of which are fatal. Dr. Ravi Johar with United Healthcare says a cardiac arrest can happen to a teenager playing baseball who's hit by a ball at the exact moment in the heartbeat cycle that disrupts it. He says family medical history and genetics can help determine if someone is prone to experience cardiac arrest or a heart attack. Screening and tests are encouraged for those with high-risk family history.
Things like Marfan syndrome increases the risk of aneurysms and abnormal blood flow to the heart and things of that sort. So there can be some genetic consequences. There can also be genetic history. If your parents had problems with their hearts, there's a higher likelihood that you may.
Experts say routine cardiac care can help ensure a better quality of life, especially as a person ages, including getting EKGs and ultrasounds that can help prevent many issues further down the road. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez. Find our ATRUST indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
As we said, February is American Heart Month, and new data shows a rise in heart-related deaths during the first year of the pandemic. That's renewing calls to beef up prevention efforts and to put the spotlight on issues of healthcare access for communities of color. Mike Moen has more on this research in South Dakota.
The U.S. saw a surge in cardiovascular-related deaths during the first year of the pandemic. Voices from South Dakota's health community hope it spurs more work to prevent these outcomes. New findings from the American Heart Association show there were more than 920,000 heart-related deaths in 2020, the highest total since 2003. The report says it shows how COVID-19 can impact cardiovascular health, including connections to risk factors for heart disease and stroke. Chrissy Meyer, AHA spokesperson for South Dakota, says that's why it's vital for people to get CPR training, knowing that most cardiac arrests happen inside the home.
If you're ever called upon to give CPR, it most likely is going to be for a family member or a friend or someone you know and love. And so that's really kind of where the urgency comes in, so that everyone is trained and knows how to respond in a cardiac emergency.
Meyer says it's also important to consider healthier lifestyle choices, from eating to exercise, to keep those risk factors at bay. Meanwhile, the Heart Association says the Asian, Black, and Hispanic communities saw the biggest increases in heart-related deaths, prompting the need to improve access to preventative care for providers and health agencies. Shannon Bacon of the Community Healthcare Association of the Dakotas says many social and structural barriers can affect health outcomes. She says that's why community health centers are now tailoring their patient screenings to look at what she describes as the social drivers of health.
And so this is a recognition that we can provide excellent clinical care, and yet we also need to pay attention and ask questions like, does someone have enough food at home? Do they have a place to sleep? Are they at risk of losing housing?
She says that can spark conversations about how to access other types of resources. Bacon adds South Dakota's recent move to pass Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act will play a role in establishing more equitable health outcomes. The new statistics from the Heart Association coincide with the start of American Heart Month. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Code Pink Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will be cloudy and cold with an overnight low of 28 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be similarly cloudy and cold with a daytime high of 47. Today in history, 1960, four Black students staged the first of the Greensboro sit-ins at a lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina. The quote of the day is from American sociologist and Pan-Africanist civil rights activist W.E.B. Du Bois. He said, quote, "The cost of liberty is less than the price of oppression."
Thank you.
The anniversary of the Bear River Massacre 160 years ago was marked in Idaho with plans to build a cultural interpretive center at the site. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The 160th anniversary of the Bear River Massacre was recently marked with an event at the site of the attack in Idaho. The Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation plans to build a cultural interpretive center at the site. Amy Van Tatenhove reports.
Over 150 years ago, the United States Army attacked and killed as many as 500 Shoshone men, women, and children in northern Cache Valley, Idaho. The attack resulted in one of the largest slaughters of Native Americans in U.S. history. The site of the attack along the Bear River, or Wootoogwa, had been used for hundreds of years as a place for trade, cultural exchange, and socialization by the Shoshone Nation. Darren Perry, former chairman of the Northwestern Band of the Shoshone Nation, spoke at an event honoring the victims of the attack. He shared that the site has remained a priority for the Shoshone, despite the tragedy that unfolded at the hands of the U.S. Army.
When something terrible happens at a place where human lives are lost, that place always seems to take on a new meaning. The 14.6 acres of the World Trade Centers, the beaches of Normandy, a homemade memorial at the site of the road where a fatal traffic accident occurred.
In partnership with local universities and ecological consultants, the Shoshone Nation has ambitious plans to honor victims of the massacre and to share Shoshone culture with an interpretive center. Brian Andrews, an environmental engineer on the project, says the partnership is hoping to encourage outdoor recreation and appreciation of the site with a system of walking trails, a waterway for canoes and paddleboards, and interpretive signage throughout.
When you come here, when it's ultimately done, we'll have trees and things along that cornfield. What we'd like you to do is to go back in time.
For National Native News, I'm Amy Van Tatenhove.
On Tuesday, tribal leaders gathered at the Capitol in Salt Lake City to advocate for the protection of the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act to keep Native children with Native families at the state level in Utah. Representatives from some of Utah's eight tribal nations encouraged state lawmakers to support House Bill 40 to codify ICWA. During a press conference, Navajo Nation Council Delegate Eugenia Charles Newton expressed her appreciation for the bill, saying, as an elected official, it's rare to see a state want to work with Native Americans to protect the family unit.
To see a state and our tribe work hand in hand to preserve the right for our Utah citizens to know who they are, where they come from, and to have a connection to their people. I am aware that the Navajo Nation worked with the state of Utah to draft, review, and discuss the Utah ICWA House Bill 40. To ensure the best interests of the state of Utah, the Navajo Nation, Navajo children, and families are honored and recognized.
A House committee recently voted to hold the bill from advancing to the floor. Representative Christine Watkins is the bill's sponsor.
We ran into a little bit of a hiccup, and we have lots of people trying to educate committee members so that they We'll all support this.
The bill in Utah is being considered as the Indian Child Welfare Act is being challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court. The Associated Press reports former Dances with Wolves actor Nathan Chasing Horse has been arrested in Las Vegas, Nevada, in an alleged sex abuse case. He's accused of sexual assault and human trafficking. Police say he used his position as a so-called medicine person to abuse young Native girls. Chasing Horse allegedly committed offenses in multiple states and Canada. No attorney was listed for him as of Tuesday for comment. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Seven Colorado River Basin states failed to reach an agreement on a 15 to 20% decline in water allocation by the Department of Interior's deadline. It's the second time in 6 months the states failed to come to an agreement on water usage from the Colorado River. Without an agreement, the agency will need to impose cuts. Six states, Arizona, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming, agreed to slash water use, but California, the largest water consumer, refused. Meanwhile, on Wall Street, farmland in that region, or more precisely the water rights that go with that farmland, are a hot investment. The Future of Water Act is proposed by Representative Ro Khanna and Senator Elizabeth Warren. It would amend the Commodity Exchange Act to affirm that water is a human right to be managed for public benefit, not a commodity to be bought and sold by investment firms. Much of the water of the Colorado River comes from Rocky Mountain snowpack, which has declined over the past decades due to increased temperatures and an ongoing 23-year mega drought. That mega drought is more severe than anything seen in the preceding 1,200 years.
The annual winter monarch butterfly count of more than 335,000 shows a substantial improvement over the last few years, but experts say it's still low compared to historical numbers. Suzanne Potter reports.
This winter, volunteers counted more than 335,000 Western monarch butterflies in the annual survey, a big improvement over the last few years, but still far short of historical numbers. Observers only counted 2,000 of the iconic black and orange butterflies in 2020 and then 250,000 in 2021. Rebecca Quinones-Pinon, monarch recovery strategist for the National Wildlife Federation, says that still represents a 90% decline in numbers over the past few decades.
In the late 80s and the early 90s, the count of monarchs was very high, and one of the highest numbers that was recorded was in 1997 with 1.2 million monarchs.
She says experts would need to see an average of 500,000 monarchs over a period of 5 years in order to consider the monarch population stable. In California, the public can visit large clusters of monarch butterflies for a few more weeks at Pismo State Beach, in Pacific Grove near Monterey, and at Natural Bridges in Santa Cruz County. This winter, 250 volunteers conducted the butterfly counts at 272 overwintering sites coordinated by the Xerces Society. The biggest clusters of monarchs were found on private property in Santa Barbara County. Quinones-Pinon says going forward, California needs to work to protect butterfly habitat and continue the fight against global warming.
Habitat loss and fragmentation, which is completely exacerbated by climate change, and the heavy use of pesticides are the three top threats to the monarch butterfly. And that's where we need to focus.
She and other experts say people can do their part by planting butterfly-friendly gardens filled with native nectar plants and native milkweed. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Eye care professionals are urging people to be mindful that prolonged exposure to blue light from smartphones and computers can disrupt the natural sleep-wake cycle and potentially cause eye strain, headaches, and other negative health effects. Tramell Gomes has more.
With the increasing use of digital devices and computers in daily life, we're all exposed to more and more blue light. They may be convenient and help us stay connected, but prolonged exposure could pose real health risks. One of those risks is interfering with the body's circadian rhythm, the internal clock that regulates a person's sleep cycle. Throwing that off can cause insomnia, headaches, and eye strain. Dr. Joseph Nesgoda, with the Florida Society of Ophthalmology, says this doesn't mean a person should completely block out blue light, because a broad spectrum of light is needed throughout the day. But it's important to manage exposure.
Individuals are just, you know, usually on their devices, you know, much longer and later than usual. Potentially during those times, it may be good to limit the exposure. Again, you know, there's been convincing data in animal models, but in humans, the jury's still out.
One tip is scheduling an eye exam. Others include taking breaks around every 20 minutes from digital screens by looking at something else at least 20 feet away for 20 seconds. And of course, limit screen times before bed. Dr. Scott Edmonds, Chief Eye Care Officer for United Healthcare Vision, says eye specialists became concerned during the pandemic about blue light exposure as more people started using digital devices for longer time periods at home. He worries that soon some of the same concerns will surface about blue light that happened with ultraviolet light.
The photoreceptors can certainly process blue light, but it puts a lot of strain on them, and we're concerned that over time the retina will become damaged and we'll start to see age-related macular degeneration from this, like we did with UV light.
In addition to taking screen breaks, eye care professionals recommend making sure your computer screens are clear and clean as researchers continue to study potential dangers. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has some answers.
Some things are so simple. To solve the deficit, tax the rich more, and cut defense spending and corporate subsidies. To stabilize Social Security, raise the limit on what's drawn into the fund. If only we had majority rule, publicly funded campaigns, the ruling reversed that granted corporations rights. If only there were some kind of supervisors to talk to elected officials who weren't doing their sworn duty to shape up or go home. All the energy being put in by right-wing think tanks and state governments to restrict voting shows how important our votes are. Or is it just that if we didn't have voting, people might take other, more active steps to get the government they want, like the million French in the streets because Macron wants to cut their government pensions? Soon it'll be spring, and by then I'm sure the Supreme Court and Republican Congress will give us some fine reasons to be out in protest, out supporting new progressive laws and leaders. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 1st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, curiosities, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Dan Raphael, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Suzanne Potter, Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, Mike Moen, Tramel Gomes, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.